It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the last of three episodes based on our interview with Mary Dearborn, author of an upcoming biography of Carson McCullers to be published by Knopf.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
You know, saying at the beginning of this interview, I've always been fascinated by literary biography, of all kinds, really, but especially literary biography. And I just wonder, how do you start? What is the process for taking on something like this?
Oh, well, the best thing about it is you're reading somebody's mail. I mean, that's what you do, is you read their letters and letters to them. Mostly their letters are what you want. And they're very vulnerable. People are very vulnerable in their letters. And even once they're, you know, famous and they think they might be saved. I just start from a kind of understanding their emotional, beginning to get their emotional complexity. And then, you know, yeah, there's stuff like you finding out about their ancestry, but... You know, and having to put those early childhood things in. But that was really exciting with Carson. I was able to, anybody could do on ancestry.com, but three of her ancestors had slaves, which isn't, unless you're a dirt poor Southerner in that time, that's not that unusual. But, I mean, that was interesting. And how much, I got fixated for a long time as, when did Carson know that? Because her grandmother's father was a war hero, was a Civil War hero, and there's and her his wife, his widow, erected a statue, but just one of the columns, which cost $5,000 then. You know, that's a lot of money. So there's no way that Carson wouldn't have known that. And Southern kids in general, I guess, have to learn about slavery, and I just got fixated on how that might have happened. And of course, we have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know when Carson learned it. It couldn't have been kept from her. But anyway, that kind of thing. And that you just get propelled along. You want to know more, you know.
You were here in Columbus once or twice. How many times have you been here?
I've been down there twice. And twice,
yeah.
I'd like to go again.
Yeah, well, we'd love to have you, and I know that you spent time in the archives, and spent time, you stayed in the Smith McCullers house, Carson's childhood home, and I'm curious what your impressions of Columbus were, you know, this town where Carson grew up.
I love Columbus. I think it's amazing, and I'm so impressed by I'm sure, I don't know what its economic situation is now, but how that city has managed to stay on its feet and the evolution of Columbus State. I mean, that's a really great story. You know, it's, I was so impressed when I asked the volunteer archivist, Tom, asked Tom how the football team was at Columbus State. He said, there is no football team. What?
You know,
that's so wonderful.
Think we've escaped. You know, at this point, it's hard to imagine that we would have a football program. So yeah, I think we're almost in the clear on that issue.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And you know, the art museum is fantastic. I was really impressed, and I mean, I actually really like it down there. I love the architecture, the domestic, you know, the range of and like the Carson McCullers, that kind of bungalow thing. I can imagine that it could be pretty stifling, though, you know, Bibi was having those people over, you know, these sort of salons and meeting Edwin Peacock, and she's pretty young when, so almost like after she got over the music phase, and she started meeting these really interesting people a year or two later. And I'm sure it felt small, but I think she also loved it. She wasn't one of those people who hated where she came from.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, that's interesting. Of course, she's had a sort of a rocky relationship with her hometown. I think a lot of people mistakenly feel that her books are basically an airing of the town's dirty laundry, which I think is very short-sighted. And a lot of people who think that, I don't think have actually read the books. They just know about Carson McCullers because she became famous. And, you know, I'm sure you know a lot about the way that she behaved and the way that Bibi behaved and the way that she allowed Carson to behave was scandalous at the time, you know, smoking cigarettes on the street and all that sort of stuff. You know, a number of the people that you just mentioned, Edwin Peacock, Mary Tucker. Carson met those because of Fort Benning. This is an aspect of Columbus that's true today. I have had a number of students who were either military or military dependent, or for some, you know, the military brought them to Columbus, and it makes this place a lot more diverse than a lot of other southern towns who don't have something like that. And, you know, at Columbus State University, when we have our graduation ceremony, and they read the names of the students who are graduating and put their names up there, you realize this place is about as diverse as you can get. It is diverse in every way that can be measured. And I got to feel like that had some impact on Carson and on her development.
You know, I hadn't thought about Fort Benning that way, but of course it's true. No. And they're getting in like this certain slice of young men, basically, who don't see many other options for themselves. But they can be, I think Reeves is a great example, because he comes from a poor background, and yet he's so smart. And he's from this family, all of them, I don't know, not the father, he was long gone, but they left to go to New York City. You know, they were, you know, would-be cosmopolitans. And that's pretty amazing that, you know, if you can tap into that culture at all, which she did through Mary Tucker, and then I guess through Edwin Peacock knowing Reeves, you know, that there's... Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, she heard stories like the one in Reflections of a Golden Eye, a bit of Peeping Tom, that just sent her off into, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. It made a big difference.
Are there other things about Columbus, do you think, that, you know, had a powerful influence on Carson and on the writer that she became?
It's hard for me to, you know, she remains so aloof. Like from school and things, she wasn't somebody who, you know, she had a favorite English teacher or anything like that. She was aloof. She was on her own. But it's probably me speaking as a northerner, but I just get that whole southern, and I'm going to talk in cliches, but things like the Scuppermong Arbor, you know, and the various kinds of vegetation there are down there, and the way the town is laid out, where there are mills next to the river, and then there's, you know, the town is it's a very interesting town in terms of neighborhoods, you know, or what the neighborhoods were then. And I just think, you know, I'm sorry, also I can't help but picture Heart is a Lonely Hunter, member of the Wedding, like Frankie going downtown. That's how I picture Columbus. And I think she, you know, she couldn't get it out of her, I don't think.
Yeah, it's true. I wanted to circle back to a question about your previous biography of Hemingway. Again, this is from Showalter's review. She says, Showalter also points out that you trace, quote, Hemingway's persistent confusion about gender identity to Grace's androgynous mothering style, his hair fetish, a sexual fascination with matching short haircuts and bleached blonde hair for men and women, which became a theme in the gender-bending posthumous novel, The Garden of Eden, could be judged as a shameful secret, but also, she argues, as openness to fluidity and gender boundaries, end quote. Is that a connection, do you think, that you found between Hemingway and McCullers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Hemingway, it's obviously it's very strange in this avatar of masculinity. You find this, at bottom, gender fluidity. And, you know, his son was a lifelong transvestite who started to have operations toward the end of his life. And I don't come out and say this because how can we possibly say about somebody? I think partly because of his son, he was very interested in these kinds of gender fluid situations, like in the Garden of Eden, but also he was really drawn to them. And what I'm saying you can't tell now is we don't know whether he would have wanted to have a sex change or just, but I think he would have been part of the conversation. And Carson, I'm actually less sure. I mean, there are so many indications that she loved, you know, wearing men's clothes or clothes that have features of men's clothes on them, and that she was a quote-unquote tomboy, bad term, but I think you feel this way about somebody who is pretty comfortable in her own skin when you think they probably wouldn't have changed. I think, again, she would have been really interested in the conversation, mm-hmm. and she might have used they and them for her pronouns. I mean, she's it's definitely something that would have fascinated her, and she would have loved it, I think. Yeah. But whether or not she would, again, I can't, you know, how can we possibly say? But yeah, this was, I think of her a lot, you know, when I hear a lot of this discussion, and just she would love how confounding it can be, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that was another question I had for you then. What would you say is Carson McCullers' legacy at this point?
There are what I think she did in her fiction, which I won't really go into here, except to say, I think had she written a little more, she would be in the pantheon of our best, and is still. But in terms of, I think of everything biographically. I think of what her life has to offer to people coming after us, and especially, say, young lesbians, or especially anyone who doesn't, she's always been good for anyone who sees themselves as outside, you know, as freakish, as that. I mean, people need Member of the Wedding and Heart is the Lonely Hunter in a way that I don't think they need A Farewell to Arms. You know, they're great to have, but I think Carson's life is what's really valuable for us to say. And, you know, that's self-serving because I write Carson's life, but I think that's the amazing thing about her. And she has such a presence in a way I haven't felt about my other subjects. You know, I feel closeness to her that, well, I certainly didn't feel that about Henry Miller, or that's not how I would characterize it. But anyway, no, and I think the value of what she wrote, that's not going to disappear. You know, to the extent that people keep reading, which is more of an if. But no, I really feel strongly about that, and I hope she's read more widely even. Mm-hmm. Ballad of the Sad Cafe and Reflections on a Golden Eye, which in a way is my favorite, just aren't read enough.
No, it's true. I think they are undervalued. And I'm like you. I think The Heart is the Lonely Hunter, to me, is the big book, you know. And Jen Chaplin said something interesting. She said, you know, it's two different questions. Which one do I think is the most important, and which one do I like the most? And she, you know, she says that she likes Member of the Wedding, but she thinks maybe Clock Without Hands is the most important. And this has always been fascinating to me, how people who are big admirers disagree on that subject. You know, Hilton Ahls, he said, now, Ballad of the Sad Cafe, now that's the important work. And I know a lot of French critics think that Reflections in a Golden Eye, that's the important work.
Tell me yours, most important and like the best.
Well, I think that in my case, it's both what I think is most important and the best, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And that is because, it's the big canvas. Yeah, you know, it seems to me that she slings out there all of the themes, the major themes that she's going to deal with throughout her work. And they're all in that one book. And it's unbelievable the way that she is able to imagine herself into the lives of people so different from her. That, you know, I have reread it and taught it a number of times. And every time I do, I'm amazed all over again. It's like, wow, how did someone so young have that sort of perception? And I think things like, you know, her big theme to me is this desire to belong, for all of us, you know, to want to belong, to have a we of me,
right,
as she puts
right,
it, a member
right.
of the wedding. And for her to have John Singer be hearing impaired, and to have sign language be his only way of communicating with someone, it's like a stroke of brilliance, you know? That's both my favorite and the one that I think is most important. But I also can appreciate the appeal of The Member of the Wedding, and I also love it. And it's got some great set pieces in it. And The Ballad of the Sad Cafe, the whole lover-beloved thing, for one thing, is great. And as it has been pointed out to me by Jen Chaplin and by Carlos Dues, I think that Clock Without Hands should be reevaluated. I think that it's a lot better book than a lot of people say, and it may be the most imperfect of her major works, But there are passages in it that I think are just fantastic. And again, same with Reflections in a Golden Eye. There are parts of it that I just love. And one of the things I love about that book is that living here in Columbus and having been on Fort Benning on a number of occasions, it's impossible if you've been on Fort Benning and you read that book not to think of Benning and vice versa. You know, if you've read that book and you go on Fort Benning, you go, oh, here it is, you know, right here.
No wonder they were upset.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, we always ask our interviewees if they'll read a favorite passage of McCullers from us. And I'm wondering if you have anything that you've brought along that you might want to read for us.
I do. It's from The Heart of the Lonely Hunter, and I think it's probably, I wish I were being more original in a way, but I think this is what a lot of people love in this about Nick Kelly, and this is about her listening to people's radios when she's outside. In the quiet, secret night, she was by herself again. It was not late. Yellow squares of light showed in the windows of the houses along the streets. She walked slow, with her hands in her pockets and her head to one side. For a long time, she walked without noticing the direction. Then the houses were far apart from each other, and there were yards with big trees in them and black shrubbery. She looked around and saw she was near this house where she had gone so many times in the summer. Her feet had just taken her here without her knowing. When she came to the house, she waited to be sure no person could see. Then she went through the side yard. The radio was on as usual. For a second, she stood by the window and watched the people inside. The bald-headed man and the gray-haired lady were playing cards at a table. Mick sat on the ground. This was a very fine and secret place. Close around were thick cedars so that she was completely hidden by herself. The radio was no good tonight. Somebody sang popular songs that all ended in the same way. It was like she was empty. She reached in her pockets and felt around with her fingers. There were raisins and a buckeye and a string of beads, one cigarette with matches. She lighted the cigarette and put her arms around her knees. It was like she was so empty. There wasn't even a feeling or thought in her. One program came on after another, and all of them were punk. She didn't especially care. She smoked and picked a little bunch of grass blades. After a while, a new announcer started talking. He mentioned Beethoven. She had read in the library about that musician. His name was pronounced with an A and spelled with a double E. He was a German fellow like Mozart. When he was living, he spoke in a foreign language and lived in a foreign place, like she wanted to do. The announcer said they were going to play his Third Symphony. She only halfway listened because she wanted to walk some more and she didn't care much what they played. Then the music started. Mick raised her head and her fist went up to her throat. How did it come? For a minute, the opening balanced from one side to the other, like a walk or march. Like God strutting in the night. The outside of her was suddenly froze, and only that first part of the music was hot inside of her heart. She could not even hear what sounded after, but she sat there waiting and froze with her fists tight. After a while, the music came again, harder and loud. It didn't have anything to do with God. This was her, Mick Kelly, walking in the daytime and by herself at night. In the hot sun and in the dark, with all the plans and feelings, the music was here, the real plain her.
Yeah, I love that passage as well. But I want to ask you, why that passage? Why did you choose that one?
Good question, because I was looking at it and I didn't get to the part where she hears kind of each movement of the symphony, and I'm like, that never happened to me. I'm not musical, you know, and yet, you know, her ability to say what that was like. And then also the, it's just total identification. When I was her age, I did almost the same thing. You know, I'd go around snooping in my town and stuff, and I always wanted to know more about people, you know, and just that she would find that place and in the cedars where she can't see her, and she's plucking at the blades of grass. I mean, it's indelible. I wish in a way I, you know, and reading it aloud, you can just see the mastery, you know, of the language. And I, in a way, I wish I'm going to manage somehow to read aloud a different passage about somebody else and see if I see her working that same kind of incredible magic. Mick Kelly is just, it's as simple as identifying her from the age of, you know, 11 or 12 when I first read her until now, and probably until I die, that Mick Kelly is kind of sitting in those cedars, is listening to the somebody else's radio, is going to stick with me.
Yeah, that image of her being outside, like you said, and plucking the grass, and there's something about that is just so compelling. You know, it's hard to say, but yeah, that's one of my favorite things to remember from that. There are other ones that you were talking about, how when you're in the Smith McCullers house and you thought of, remember the wedding, I also think of, and you do, right, all those scenes in the kitchen, right? Yes. But I also think of that neighborhood in reading The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And for instance, when early on she climbs on top of the house that is under construction to smoke a cigarette.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you find out that when the family moved there, all the houses in the neighborhood weren't yet built. So that is probably, you know, an experience that she had in that neighborhood.
Right.
And there it is right there in the book. And so I always think of that, you know, when I'm in that neighborhood and think of the neighborhood when I'm reading that.
Right. That's cool. That's really cool.
Well, thank you so much, Mary, for being with us today. And I'm really looking forward to your book coming out. I can't wait. And if you had to guess, what would you say would be the book?
It's totally on whatever. But I think in spring or summer of, is that 2022? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
About 9 months after I turned it in, usually. But we'll see.
Like I said, it'll be much anticipated by everyone in the Carson McCullers world. So we'll
thank you.
Well, have a great day, and thank you again so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullers Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullers Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullers' 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. Mary Dearborn's reading from The Heart is a Lonely Hunter is in the Library of America's The Collected Works of Carson McCullers. The music you heard during the reading was Sospiri Opus 70 by Edward Elgar, performed live in Legacy Hall by the Schwab Philharmonic on November 9th, 2020.